You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It's Friday, time for our reporter roundtable, where we get you up to date on all the news that made headlines around our region this past week. Joining me live in studio are Don Day with BoiseDev.com, Mike Sharp with KIVI Television, and joining us by phone at the State House is Betsy Russell with the Idaho Press. Welcome, everyone.
Hi. Hello.
Thanks for having us.
Well, just a busy day, busy week. So, Betsy, I want to start with you since you were at the State House covering everything legislative. A lot going on, to say the least. But let's get started with Medicaid expansion, but the lawsuit, because the Supreme Court heard arguments earlier this week.
That's right. We had the arguments at the Supreme Court from both sides in the lawsuit challenging the voter-passed initiative to expand Medicaid. And they were absolutely fascinating. The justices were really engaged. They had lots and lots of questions. One thing they made really clear, I thought, was that they weren't inclined to throw the case out on procedural grounds, although there are lots and lots of procedural issues about whether this is properly filed, whether there's standing, and so forth. They wanted to get to the merits. And the merits are the question of whether the initiative is unconstitutional as a delegation of state lawmaking authority to the federal government and the executive branch of state government. The justices did not seem convinced at all, I thought, from their questions. Now, I know that you cannot necessarily judge where judges or justices are going based on their questions. They could be playing devil's advocate or something like that. But they said by the logic that was presented by the Idaho Freedom Foundation to say that this is an unconstitutional delegation, why our entire Medicaid program would be unconstitutional. Every state law that references a federal law, like our law tying Idaho's minimum wage to the federal minimum wage, would be unconstitutional. Highway funding bills would be unconstitutional. It kind of goes a long way. So I think it gave us some hints of what's coming, but we won't know for sure until the justices rule and issue their decision.
And Mike, you're nodding your head over there.
Yeah, I'm nodding because I would imagine that the Idaho Freedom Foundation would agree with all of those things as well, that they probably also believe that those funding mechanisms are also illegal.
Mike, talk about the bipartisan bill to recognize PTSD and workers' comp claims. We've talked about this on the program before. We've had Boise Fire Chief Dennis Stone in, who has been a big advocate of this. But where, A, what is this? And then B, where are we at with it?
Yeah, so right now, if you were to be a first responder to a case that is specifically harmful to you for whatever reason, you would not get workers' comp for that case. So, you know, you can hurt your arm, you can hurt your leg, you can put your hip out, but if you're emotionally damaged, you don't get that same claim. This would enable first responders to have access to those benefits statewide. There are some cities that I've heard about that have added some sort of funding mechanism to make sure that that's available for their employees, mm-hmm. but nothing statewide. It has a lot of support on both sides of the aisle, but it's been interesting. I've talked to a couple members at the State House who asked for anonymity because they haven't seen the legislation yet, but they have concerns about whether or not somebody who recognizes they have PTSD should be a first responder in the first place, which was an interesting point to be brought up. Should people be running into fires if they've recognized that fires are a trigger for that PTSD? And whether or not in certain situations, like even the car crash under Cloverdale, mm-hmm. right, and on June 1st, supposedly, you know, there were a lot of people who were affected by that. If you're showing up and there are 10 cars that are on fire and you're cleaning up four bodies, it's going to impact a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So how do you make sure that all those people are receiving their care in a way that is economical and isn't going to put the budget for those cities in danger? So there are some concerns, but it does sound like they have quite a range of people who are in support.
And I also want to talk about, there have been talk of a minimum wage bill, and this is a personal bill. And Mike and Betsy, this is geared a little bit more towards the two of you, because this will probably not see the light of day, correct?
Correct. I mean, and Betsy can talk, you know, she has her own opinions, and
Betsy's been covering this stuff forever.
I'm not here to give opinions.
Well, yeah, correct. But when it comes to my opinion specifically.
We've actually had three minimum wage bills introduced. They were all introduced as personal bills in the House. And in the House, the custom under Speaker Behnke has been that personal bills, those bills that are supported by one legislator but haven't gone through a committee, don't get hearings. They get referred to the Ways and Means Committee, and there they die.
And will that probably what will happen with these three minimum wage bills, Betsy?
Yes. I mean, they've already been referred to that committee.
Oh,
right. And when it comes to personal bills, and that's when I talk about opinion, I mean, as a journalist covering the Idaho State House, not as long as Betsy, but for a while, you learn to kind of turn off the noise. And a lot of times that's what personal bills are. They usually come from the minority party. If the minority party isn't able to get their piece of legislation through their committee and they don't have the support, they'll do personal bills. If you see somebody from the majority party do it, it's usually an idea that's outside the mainstream. You saw it with Heather Scott's bill related to abortion earlier this session. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times it's bills that just won't have that support. It still enables them to get some sort of public attention or hearing. Mm-hmm. Typically, they're not going to go anywhere. I can't remember one that really went anywhere.
But that's good information to know, just as an average citizen, of what a personal bill looks like in the Idaho legislature.
Right, and a lot of times
they say that there's a difference between the House and the Senate. And so the Senate does not have this custom that the House has of personal bills simply will not get hearings. And in the past, personal bills have been introduced in the Senate and have ended up passing and becoming law. And so a personal bill that was introduced in the Senate so far this session was Senator Marianne Jordan's bill to add the words, to change the Idaho Human Rights Act to include non-discrimination protections on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. So that, even though the chances are that that may not get a hearing, it could get a hearing. And there is no particular rule or custom that says it can't.
Right. It's just leadership.
Don, I want to bring you into the conversation. So you did some digging into campaign finance filings, in particular for the mayors of Boise and Meridian. So talk to me about that and the fact that we are in an election cycle again.
Yeah, 2019 is obviously an election year in the cities around the valley and around the state. And I think it's going to be a referendum on growth in both Boise and Meridian. Are people happy with the way things are happening, or do they want to see change? And I always like to see where the money comes from for these candidates. So one of the great things about Idaho law is there's a very healthy sunshine law that requires candidates to say who donated to their campaigns. Mm-hmm. The challenge is that a lot of those filings are faxed into city clerk's offices and then put up on websites as flat PDFs. So you can't really do any analysis. So starting in June, I went through the last election cycle, which was 2015, and looked at all the donations to both Mayor Tammy DeVeard in Meridian and Mayor David Beter here in Boise, and kind of put those in a database, and that allowed me to do some analysis and see, you know, where do these folks that are donating to these campaigns come from? And, you know, it's interesting in Meridian, the mayor there, about 45% or so of her donors come from the development industry, and another 32% come from business. It's what you might expect, but it helps give some framework for this upcoming campaign. And in Boise, you see a little bit of a similar pattern for Mayor Beter, where about 29% of his donations come from the development industry, 25% come from business. But what's interesting in Boise is about 9% of his donations came from fire unions, and not just here in Boise, but from across the state.
Hmm.
And that kind of comes into play because you think about the fact that we had a bond issue for – or a bond election for some new fire stations and a new fire training center. And so you start to be able to see kind of the patterns from where the money came from and some of the policy outcomes. So it hopefully will help people really better understand where the dollars that are funding the candidates come from as they start to make decisions coming into this next cycle.
And that's interesting just about the growth part of it when you talk about, you know – developers.
Yeah, I mean, I think statewide elections in Idaho tend to, and Betsy and Mike can chime in here, but they tend to relate more to social issues and issues that are more important in the rural areas of the state because the political power still very much lies there. But if you live in Boise, Meridian, Nampa, Caldwell, Eagle, all those cities, growth is what you're really paying attention to. And the biggest lever that they can push to affect change there is the elections at City Hall.
Betsy, I want to talk about these possible changes to current liquor law, our current liquor law license. This, first off, explain it to us. And is this going to go somewhere potentially?
So it's very complicated. It's a lengthy bill.
Yeah.
And something similar was actually proposed by then-Governor Butch Otter back in 2009. And it ended up dying by one vote in the Senate. And Senator Jim Rice has brought it back this time. And I think it does have the potential to go somewhere. Idaho's liquor license system, which sets quotas on how many liquor licenses are available for bars and restaurants in cities around the state, is, everyone agrees, it's completely archaic. Basically, the only way to get a liquor license outside of an incorporated city is to hire a lobbyist and get a special bill passed in the legislature. And as a result, we have these bizarre laws littering our books saying, well, if it's a bed and breakfast that's on a lake of which has this many gallons of water and it has this many rooms, then it can get a liquor license, a special one. And that was for the Clark House up on Hayden Lake.
Well, see, I mean, there you go.
That's just nuts. And so what Senator Rice is proposing is a new system in which the existing state licenses would be grandfathered in, and in the future, all new licenses could be issued by cities and counties at local option if they choose to. And so we may have some that choose not to. And those city and county issued licenses would be only for restaurants and hotels, not just bars, only for places that serve food as well as alcohol. And so for bars, they would have to stick with the old state issued licenses, which still will be around and still could be purchased on the secondary market if there aren't any available under the quota. But the bill would also open it up so that those existing licenses could be sold from one city in the state to another, whereas right now they have to be bought from within the same city. And as a result, a liquor license in Boise can sell for $200,000 on the secondary market, mm-hmm. whereas it might only be worth $1,000 or $2,000 out in some small town. So that would change the whole dynamic.
And past
these changes are incredibly controversial because they affect people who've invested a lot of money into the current system.
Yeah, and I was just going to say that's what has kind of stopped it, is these people who have invested in these licenses and counted as an asset on their books. If you just get rid of the system, then they've spent all this money and they're kind of out the money. So this is an interesting compromise that sort of tries to bridge that gap.
And it's interesting. We talked to Senator Rice before the session about this piece of legislation that he was going to be presenting. And we talked to a couple bar owners. And it's interesting because one of the big proponents of it is Bardonet, who you would think, you know, that they've obviously spent the money to earn their licenses, mm-hmm. but they're trying to build that compromise. But then other bars are just saying, no, like we can't afford to give up this one asset that we do have. We spent this money. The next people who are coming in should have to spend the same amount of money. And it's tough because, you know, Senator Rice's response to that was, you know, there's no constitutional protection for you to have that benefit mm-hmm. Just because you spent that money. However, if you spent that money, the $200,000 that she had mentioned, you're going to be not so happy about the fact that the next guy coming in your town doesn't have to pay that.
And it is interesting. I was looking at business filings yesterday, and there are a bunch of Boise and Meridian liquor licenses on the aftermarket, more than I've seen in a long time. And I think it's a direct result of this legislation and people getting a little nervous that their licenses may have a little less value in 6 months.
So sell them now.
Yeah.
Well, and what's interesting to me about this, Betsy, is what you said about being able to sell them city to city. Because if you think about certain, you know, municipalities in our state, there are certain cities that do not sell alcohol, whether it's in a hotel or a restaurant. So if they have a certain, you know, excess, you could potentially sell those? Is that accurate?
You know, I can't say that I have a full grasp of every detail.
Okay.
How does it work? I mean, when you start talking about it, it's quite complicated. And there's definitely going to be a learning curve for everyone on all sides of the issue to learn what's being proposed and see how it fits in with their situation and whether or not they're okay with it. But we're at the point where the bill has just been introduced. Mm. It's out there in the public. People can start looking through it and talking about it. And there will be public hearings. And I would imagine that we're going to hear from people on all sides of this issue, including bar owners, liquor license owners, people who want liquor licenses and haven't been able to get them, people who paid a lot for them, people who are sorry that they paid a lot for them. And maybe they'll finally work this thing out.
We're continuing our Friday Reporter Roundtable. Joining me live in studio, Mike Sharp with KIVI Television, Don Day with BoiseDev.com, and joining us on the phone from the State House, Betsy Russell with the Idaho Press. Mike, I want to talk to you a little bit about some stories that the Channel 6 KIVI has done about Idaho preparing for a potential measles outbreak in light of what is going on in the state of Washington right now.
Right, and these stories are kind of difficult because you want to be cautious. You don't want to create an alarm where they're where it isn't due.
Mm-hmm.
However, you're seeing a situation in Washington and Oregon where, you know, is in Washington specifically, an emergency has been declared by the governor, 30 cases in this measles outbreak. And you have to think, if you're concerned about marijuana crossing the border, if you're concerned about alcohol and lottery people crossing the border, you probably should be concerned about just individuals with the measles crossing the mm-hmm. border. And so there is kind of a gearing up at this point. There are people, the experts at Department of Health and Welfare, the CDC, are just kind of getting ready for the fact that it could end up coming here. Obviously, children, pregnant women, anybody with vulnerable immune systems will be especially at risk, even if you have received the vaccination, because, you know, it depends on where your immunization is mm-hmm. in that process. So it's just kind of a scary thing that's floating out there. It hasn't hit us yet. But I know, you know, being a father of two young kids, I'm talking to these parents as I'm dropping kids off at school. It's a topic of conversation. Mm-hmm. It's a topic of concern among parents.
Don, go ahead, Betsy.
Well, I think it's interesting that in the Washington state legislature today, there was legislation introduced to end the ability of parents to opt out from having their kids getting the MMR vaccine because of this outbreak. And in Idaho, we really have gone the opposite direction. We make it extremely easy for parents to opt out of any immunization requirements. And as a result, we have one of the highest opt-out rates in the nation. And if that outbreak were to spread here, it could be extremely dangerous.
Right. And we're actually going to talk a little bit more about this coming up on Tuesday. So if you want to learn more information, we'll have that Tuesday here on Idaho Matters. Don, I want to talk to you about a couple of things. Let's start with Rocky's Diner in Boise. I mean, this is kind of iconic. The waitresses in roller skates. I mean, kind of if you've been in Boise for a while, you know Rocky's Diner, and it is closed.
Yeah, they had a couple of locations for a long time on Fairview. A lot of people remember. But the one on Overland has been there as long as I can remember, as growing up on the bench. And this week it closed. And not only did it close, but the Ada County Sheriff's Office actually came in and closed it down. And what happened here, and this took quite a bit of unraveling to figure out, the Idaho Department of Labor was owed pretty significant amounts of unemployment wage tax that they said had not been paid, dating back to 2010. It had piled up to more than $60,000. So they had gone to court in late 2017. They'd worked out a payment plan with the owner of Rocky's Diner in April. He was to pay $750 a week for like 62
weeks. A week?
Yeah.
Oh,
to get caught up, because he's years behind,
okay,
according to the department. And so they then went back to court in December of 2018 and said, you know what? He missed this payment, and then just stopped in September. And so we want to go in and shut this down and take the asset. So they did that earlier this week, and the restaurant closed. They went in, Ada County Sheriff's Office spokesperson Andrea Dearden said they went in early afternoon when there were no patrons there, just the owner and three employees, and they said, you guys got to go. They locked the doors, put a notice up. I understand, and I'm working to report some more here, that the owner is trying to come up with something here to get back open, and hopefully we'll know more about that in coming days. But as of right now, if you want to get breakfast or the Man versus Food hamburger mm-hmm. or go see the Harley inside, you can't, and we're not quite sure when it'll open. I've tried to reach out. I know other reporters in the market have tried to reach out to the owner, and he has not responded.
Betsy, let's talk about you're talking about possible state mandates on county governments. What's going on with this whole process?
There was a new report that came out this week from the legislature's Office of Performance Evaluations that examined in quite a bit of depth the impact of state mandates on county governments. And this is not the discussion you usually hear at the state capitol. They like to talk a lot about federal mandates on the state government. This is looking down from the state down to the counties. And what the report found was really interesting, that basically there are tons of state mandates on counties in Idaho, and the counties are really having problems with a lot of them, and particularly with their funding levels. The state pretty severely restricts the taxing ability of counties. Property tax is pretty much the only way they can raise money to fund the things that the state requires them to do. And there are limits on how much property taxes they can raise. We don't have hardly any local option taxing authority. And as part of this evaluation, many, many county officials were surveyed and interviewed, and they said that they feel like the state legislature doesn't treat them as partners. They treat them as an interest group, and they'd like some change.
Well, and didn't I read that, as you said, there was something like 400 like county officials who participated in this, and one of the things they said was really that's like you mandate something, yet there's no money to put certain procedures and processes in place, one of them being some of the new mandates with public defender offices.
That's right. I mean, the counties really feel like they're put in a box. They are required to carry out these duties by the state, but they're limited in how they can raise funds. And so if the state doesn't provide the money, it's pretty hard for them to comply. And to their credit, it was legislators who requested this review. And among the legislators who requested it was Representative Carolyn Nielsen Troy from Genesee. And she said that it was an excellent report, exactly what she was hoping for, and will allow them to look into this and see if they can make some adjustments.
So, Don, we started with growth with you, and I want to talk now about a proposed mixed-use residential project that's set for, once again, downtown Boise, correct?
Right. I think the last time I was on with you, we were talking about one of these, and this is different. So this would be at 3rd and Myrtle. So if you can kind of imagine this, it's got Winco to the east. It's got the Ada County Courthouse to the north and Julia Davis Park to the south. Mm-hmm. A group headed up by GGLO, which I just like saying on the radio.
GGLO.
GGLO is proposing to build an 8-story building that would have quite a bit of residential in it. And it would also have a significant parking component. So there'd be 174 residential units and 413 parking spaces. And some people have been like, wait, why so many parking spaces there?
Because you can't park at the courthouse or other places?
That is exactly right. They're proposing to help alleviate a parking crunch that has kind of, speaking of counties, has sort of caused problems at the Ada County Courthouse. So I think that that's kind of an interesting element. They're also saying it could help eliminate some of the surface parking in the area. But that is going to go in front of the City of Boise's Design Review Committee on Wednesday, February 13th. So if you don't have a Valentine's Eve date yet, you can go to the Design Review hearing for this project. But it's pretty interesting. Little different looking project than we've seen, although we've got a lot of residential projects that are kind of going in that strip. Local Construct has proposed what they call the Car T, which is about 2 blocks away. You have Boise Council member / CCDC commissioner / attorney Scott Ludwig, who plans to...
He's not running again, right?
He's not running. And we actually, several of us covered that this week. But he's hoping to build two towers down there. So you're really seeing this area evolve fairly quickly into an area that I think you'll see a lot of people living, and that Trader Joe's, I'm sure, will be even more busy than it is now.
Well, remember back in the day when there was like nothing? I mean, really?
You could live in the Idaho. I mean, I remember once upon a time that was kind of it downtown.
Yeah.
And now there are hundreds of units either open, coming soon, or proposed downtown. And part of that is the city's put a focus here, and they did a housing incentive to try and drive some of that. I should say this project actually won't be getting that housing incentive. That program has ended, but you did see that kind of sort of catalyze some of these projects.
All right, and before we wrap up, we have to talk about Topgolf. Now, is because you reported on this, and you said a Topgolf
style. So to be very careful here and just say that we don't know what the vendor would be, but Ball Ventures AllQuest is proposing to the City of Meridian to build something that looks an awful lot like Topgolf at Eagle and the freeway. This is the Farmstead site.
Yes, where Farmstead was.
And this just this story went crazy. People were just very excited about this. If you're not familiar what Topgolf and some of it the other type vendors in this space are, It's like if you took the Sky Suites at Boise State and you put them in front of a driving range. So you've got these nice little booths that you can get served food and alcohol and stand on a platform and tee off onto a driving range so you can play golf without ever going outside. They're climate controlled. And you might have seen these. There's one in Vegas, and actually Salt Lake now has one. So it's an interesting way to kind of play golf year-round.
Yeah, they has targets and like, different things you can aim for. It's a whole thing.
I'm a terrible golfer, but this sounds fun to me. So.
I find it odd. But hey, to each their own, right? Yeah. I want to thank all of you for coming in today. My panel today, Mike Sharp with KIVI Television, Don Day with BoiseDev.com, and by phone from the State House, Betsy Russell with the Idaho Press. Thank you all for coming in. Always one of my favorite segments of the week.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.